So we're continuing this evening our studies in 2 Kings, and we're looking at that passage that I read a few minutes ago, 2 Kings chapter 4, verses 1 to 41. Now, in terms of the ESV's layout of this chapter, our passage this evening covers 4 different sections, but I think the break which the ESV inserts after verse 17 is a bit unnecessary. Verse 18 doesn't really begin a new section. In my view, we have 3 episodes here. The one involving the widow and her oil, verses 1 to 7. The one involving the Shunammite and her son, verses 8 to 37. And the one involving the sons of the prophets and their stew, verses 38 to 41. And I think that in different ways the 3 are connected to each other. They belong together as a kind of trio. And that's going to shape our entire approach tonight. We're not going to look first at episode number 1 and then episode number 2 and then episode number 3. We're going to look rather at some of the recurring themes across the 3 episodes. It was presumably because he wanted to highlight those that the narrator arranged the episodes together like this, and that then seems a sensible way for us to proceed this evening, to consider these recurring themes that kind of unite the 3 episodes. And specifically, we're going to consider this evening doors, demands, and death. Doors, demands, and death. And first of all then, doors. Doors. One thing that you couldn't have during lockdown was audiences. So sporting fixtures took place during lockdown, but they took place behind closed doors. BBC Question Time was filmed during lockdown, but it was filmed behind closed doors. That's how events occurred over those months, not in front of a sea of faces, not in the presence of rows of spectators. They occurred behind closed doors. And in 2 of these episodes in our passage then, the main drama occurs behind closed doors. So the pouring by the widow of that one jar of oil into many jars, it doesn't take place in public view. Go in and shut the door behind yourself, verse 4. She went and shut the door behind herself, verse 5. And then the raising to life by Elisha of that dead boy. It too doesn't take place in public view. He went in and shut the door behind the 2 of them, verse 33. You might almost think that we're in COVID-stricken Britain in 2020 here, rather than the land of Israel in the 800 or 900s BC. There seems to be a similar aversion to audiences. Behind closed doors is the order of the day. And in both the episode with the widow and the episode with the boy, it results then in this bizarre conjunction. On the one hand, you have a mighty act of God taking place. Oil increasing in quantity as it's poured in a way that defies the laws of science. A corpse supernaturally becoming again a living body. On the one hand, you have a mighty act of God taking place, but then on the other hand, you have this hidden, veiled, unnoticed setting, which is the very last thing that you would expect. You'd expect hype. You'd expect lots of attention. You'd expect a major fuss. Last season, when there was some big football fixture between 2 title contestants or something, it just felt wrong that it was behind closed doors. And it feels wrong, doesn't it, that the widow's oil expands and the boy returns from death behind closed doors. Actually, with regard to the boy, the whole secrecy thing isn't confined to Elisha slamming that door shut in verse 33. It kicks in much earlier in the story. From verse 21 onwards, secrecy seems to be the name of the game. It isn't just that no one's aware a miracle is taking place there in that bedroom when Elisha shows up. No one's even aware there's any need for a miracle. No one's even aware that the boy is dead in the first place. Because actually the first person to shut that bedroom door isn't the prophet, it's the Shunammite, isn't it? There in verse 21, she shuts it, having laid the boy on the bed. Indeed, in verse 23, she won't even disclose the boy's death to her own husband, the father of the dead boy. All is well, is how she fobs him off. She's the same with Gehazi, Elisha's servant, when she meets him in verse 26. And then there's Elisha. And even before he ever gets to the point of shutting that door there in verse 33, there's already a furtiveness about him in his instructions to Gehazi there in verse 29. Tie up your garment and take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not reply. And none of this secrecy on the part of the Shunammite and on the part of the prophet is ever explained in our passage. But I'm saying it's a pattern, it's a motif that is launched then. It's already been launched in that previous episode with the low-key, unobserved, beneath-the-radar filling of the jars there. As for the third episode in our passage, there's no precise equivalent. No doors are mentioned in verses 38 to 41. But even there, the transformation of this toxic stew, which again is a mighty act of God, in its own way, it too is veiled, isn't it? Perhaps I could put it this way. It has a veneer of banality that kind of cloaks it and veils it. You know how in films, music plays a huge role. So there's a particular scene, and that scene may in fact be a bit of a non-event. But if stirring music is played, then it makes the scene seem very exciting, doesn't it? Conversely, a scene may in fact comprise an epic sequence of events, but if no stirring music is played, then the scene seems unremarkable. And in verse 40 then, there's this sudden discovery that the stew is life-threatening. O man of God, there is death in the pots. And you can imagine, can't you, mid-mouth, the whole room kind of freezes. So mid-mouthful, the whole room kind of freezes, panic-stricken. And all eyes turn in desperation to Elisha. And the prophet immediately responds. Then bring, he begins. Now imagine he says, then bring my staff. Or then bring Elijah's cloak, which I inherited back at the River Jordan. Those would be impressive words, and they would have the same effect as the stirring music in the film scene. They would make the whole miracle with the stew seem epic and exciting. But he doesn't. He says, then bring flour. Flour? Flour of all things. That most lowly culinary item. It kind of sounds silly, doesn't it? It doesn't make the miracle with the stew seem exciting and epic at all. As I say, it covers the miracle with a veneer of banality. The humdrum flour is just as effective as the closed doors in episodes 1 and 2. It hides from view that something extraordinary is taking place. And I don't think then it's coincidence that our three episodes all strike this same note. The concept of God's mighty acts veiled and hidden. It's clearly a deliberate motif here. And I would put it to you, it isn't just a motif that we encounter in 2 Kings chapter 4. It's a motif we encounter repeatedly throughout history. The supreme expression of it is what we sang about a few minutes ago. The entrance of the eternal Son of God into our world and into our race. It takes place behind closed doors, involving an obscure teenage girl called Mary and an obscure farming town called Bethlehem. Apart from some famous exceptions, the local shepherds and some foreign magi, nobody notices. Nobody realizes, nobody has any idea how silently the wondrous gift is given. The next line of that hymn is interesting, actually. So God imparts to human hearts the blessings of his heaven. I may be misreading what the author meant there, but it sounds as though that's a reference to conversion. And whether that is or is not what the line's about, certainly conversion is often another instance of this principle, isn't it? Of God's mighty acts lying hidden from view, kind of veiled, low-key. You think of the psalmist in Psalm 22, verses 9 and 10. You made me trust you at my mother's breasts, he says to God. From my mother's womb, you have been my God. Now, trust in God only occurs in a human heart when a mighty act of God has transformed us and delivered us from the domain of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son God loves. And there in Psalm 22, then, you have an infant. And all he ever does is sleep and cry and suck milk. You would never think God had done something momentous and of eternal significance within him. And yet God had. I don't think the psalmist's experience is unusual. Oftentimes God works in this beneath-the-radar way, mightily regenerating infant hearts without anybody even realizing. Or you think even of adult conversions. And there too, they're often gradual, aren't they? Following the pattern of that blind man in Mark 8 who was healed by Jesus in stages, at one point able now to see men moving around but like trees walking, only later on able to see with proper clarity. Conversions to Christ often take that unspectacular outward form as a kind of veiling of the magnitude of the divine work that is going on within. Or you think of the spread of Christ's kingdom. And he himself said that it would be like yeast working its way through dough. Now, I'm not much of a baker, but I do know that yeast working its way through dough is no spectator sport. It's not compelling viewing. And so in this world, you have the dramatic developments taking place. Revolutions and referenda and changes of government and all the rest of it. And everyone's attention is drawn to those. But then you see behind the scenes all the time, Christ's kingdom is growing and growing and growing, so that you suddenly hear the numbers of believers in a place like Iran or Algeria. And you think, well, when did that happen? I'm saying this is how God works. 2 Kings 4 is typical. And you and I should be encouraged. We often feel, don't we, like God is inactive and barely doing anything at all. Barely doing anything in our lives, barely doing anything in our world. But this passage reminds us that it isn't that. It's just that he has this tendency to keep the doors closed on what he's doing. That's how God often works. That's how he works repeatedly in 2 Kings 4. That's how he works in the great event of the Son coming into the world. That's how he works in conversions. That's how he works in the spread of the kingdom. That's how God works. And so that's the first thing that we learn from this passage. And that's our first heading then, doors. Secondly, notice with me, demands. Demands. So we've seen then an explicit verbal connection between episodes 1 and 2, the reference in both to doors. There's also an explicit verbal connection between episodes 1 and 3. In both, Elisha makes the same demand. I wonder whether you noticed it. Pour. P-O-U-R. That's Elisha's demand in both episodes 1 and 3. Pour. The one jar of oil is to be poured into the many jars, verse 4. And the stew is to be poured into plates for the sons of the prophets, verse 41. Now, you might be thinking, oh, come on, Dan, now you're stretching things. That is surely not a meaningful connection. Well, I think it is, actually. Because in both cases, the demand pour must have seemed to those involved extremely strange. I mean, the demand made on the widow, it has two problems. For one thing, there's an apparent impossibility about it. One jar of oil, unless it's colossally big, simply cannot be distributed around lots of jars, filling them all. So there's an apparent impossibility, and for another thing, there's an apparent pointlessness. Even if it does work, and one jar of oil does somehow fill lots of jars, how does that help? How does that deliver the widow's sons from their imminent enslavement? And we might think, well, that's obvious, but it wasn't obvious to the widow. She doesn't seem to see pound signs flashing above those jars of oil that she's just filled. As she returns to Elisha, there in verse 7, having filled the jars, she doesn't seem to guess what she's to do next with them. So I'm saying, because of its apparent impossibility and because of its apparent pointlessness, Elisha's pouring demand must have seemed to the widow pretty weird. And then the pouring demand at that dining table in verse 41, where the sons of the prophets are seated. The problem this time isn't its apparent impossibility. It's not difficult to pour stew into a plate. Nor is it its apparent pointlessness. The sons of the prophets are hungry and they need stew. The problem there is it just seems downright risky. I mean, a moment ago, the stew was poisonous. All that's changed since then is that flour has been added to it. Is it really sensible and safe to comply with this demand that Elisha is making and pour out the stew that a moment ago was toxic? So you can see the demand by Elisha, Paul, is in both episodes 1 and 3, for slightly different reasons, eyebrow raising. As for the second episode in our passage, there's no precise equivalent. There's no eyebrow-raising, pouring demand there. But I wonder whether there too something a bit similar is going on, only in this instance with Elisha on the receiving end rather than on the issuing end of the challenging demand. You know, when the distressed Shunammite gets to Elisha there in verse 27... Now you'll notice he doesn't immediately know what the problem with her is. In verse 28, then she says, "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, do not deceive me?" And he must now, at that point, realize that the boy is at the least in a bad way and possibly dead. And it's then that he sends Gehazi. And remember, Elisha is Elijah's successor. And the similarity of this developing situation to an incident in Elijah's ministry cannot but have struck Elisha. The incident in Elijah's ministry probably occurred before Elisha was his apprentice, but he would have heard about it. And he would have heard how Elijah stretched himself upon the dead boy in that other incident, and in that way the boy came back to life. And it wouldn't have been a big leap for Elisha to infer then, this is what is demanded of me here in this situation. I must go and I must stretch myself upon the Shunammite's son, and in that way he will come back to life. And yet you can't fail to sense, can you, a reluctance in Elisha to do that. I mean, first of all, he tries two other things before ever getting to that point. He sends Gehazi with the staff in his hand to lay the staff on the boy's face. And that, of course, doesn't work. Then when he gets to the room in verse 32 and 33, he first of all tries prayer. He prays to the Lord, which may sound like it's quite pious. And Elijah, actually, he prayed in the earlier incident. But Elijah prayed in the context of stretching himself upon the dead boy. Elisha just tries to pray without doing that. Eventually, however, Elisha does stretch himself upon the boy in verse 34. But still, it seems to be a struggle for him to do this. I mean, he must have known that Elijah did it 3 times, and yet after doing it just once, Elisha seems to get cold feet, and he goes for a wander around the house for a few minutes, and then he kind of forces himself to have another go. And you think, what's going on here? Why is he being like this? Why, having such a clear model in Elijah of what was demanded of him here, why did he dither so much? Well, surely the answer is because Elisha is a human being. And even when you've witnessed a river divide upon being struck with a cloak, as Elisha had, and even when you've witnessed a spring of water become healthy upon being given a dose of salt, as Elisha had witnessed, it's still another thing altogether that death can be overturned by lying on top of the corpse. I mean, death is a vastly more serious proposition than an uncrossable river or an undrinkable spring. Surely Elisha no doubt thought, surely you have to come at it with something more reasonable and more plausible and more logical than this weird piece of theatre stretching yourself out upon the dead body. And so I'm saying that Elisha too finds himself here with a demand upon him that is eyebrow raising and that he struggles to comply with. It just seems to him so strange and so unlikely to do the job. And again, then, I don't think it's coincidence that we have this motif uniting our three episodes. This motif of demands being made upon God's people that are strange or perhaps even dangerous and risky. You see, this is part of the life of faith as we encounter it throughout the scripture. It's part of the life of faith that there are demands which appear odd or perhaps even risky. You think of the most basic demand of all in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Believe. Believe on Jesus Christ. Trust in Jesus for salvation. Lean upon his finished work. And at one level, that's not at all demanding, is it? But it's the fact it's so undemanding that actually makes it demanding. Think about, you know, you're going to some event, and it's at a place, and you know that it will take you 30 minutes to get to that place, because you've been there lots of times before, and you know it takes 30 minutes to get to that place. But someone else that you know is also going to this event at that place from a similar starting point, and there, they've never been before, they're giving it an hour. They say, oh, well, that's what the sat-nav says. That's what the AA website says. I've got to give it an hour, and so I'm going to give it an hour. And so there you are, and the event's at 3 o'clock, and at 2 o'clock, you know your friend's setting off. You're not going to set off until 2:30. And for that half an hour, you're sitting drinking coffee at home, but you're feeling a bit uneasy, aren't you? Because you're thinking, well, you know, maybe I should really have set off giving it an hour like my friend has. And although you know that it only takes 30 minutes, there's that uneasiness kind of creeping up in you during that first 30 minutes because your friend is set off already. And it's a bit like that, isn't it? Trusting in Jesus Christ in a world where people are around us are making sure they get to heaven through all kinds of elaborate rituals, religious rituals, and through strenuous moral codes. And here we are, and we're saying, oh, we're trusting in Jesus Christ. We're leaning upon what a man did on a cross 2,000 years ago. And it can start to feel to us a little bit uneasy. Should I be doing more? Should I be practicing religion more? Should I be following some code more? Should I be trying something else? Or think of the ethical demands that Christianity makes. We talked last week about sexual purity, didn't we? And our society says that you're not really living unless you're experimenting with every sexual possibility that's out there. What if they're right? That thought can strike us. Could not the demand for sexual purity result in me missing out big time? Is it risky? I'm saying there's nothing new in this phenomenon that you and I will encounter of the demands of Christianity seeming strange at times. It's what we find in 2 Kings 4. It's what we find throughout the whole of the Bible. We're in the same boat as this widow, and as this Shunammite, and as Elisha himself here in our passage. Why should we comply then with those demands that the Bible makes that sometimes seem so eyebrow raising? Well, because we know the one who has made them, don't we? We know whom we have believed and are persuaded that he is able to keep that which we have committed unto him against that day. We know Christ and we trust Christ. And we trust him to make these demands that only will be for our good. So doors, demands. But then thirdly, notice with me in our passage, death. death. And this then unambiguously is there in all three of our episodes. Verse 1, your servant, my husband, is dead, a wife of one of the sons of the prophets cries. Verse 20, when he had lifted him and brought him to his mother, the child sat on her lap till noon, and then he died. Verse 40, O man of God, there is death in the pots. This is really what Elisha is dealing with in each case. He's dealing with death. And as he deals with death then in each of these three episodes, two things to note. Number one, remember we said a couple of weeks ago, Elisha is a type of Christ, I think. I think that's a valid biblical inference. Remember we talked about Elijah being a type of John the Baptist and Elisha therefore being a type of Christ. And a second thing to note, that there's an escalation here in our passage, that we see Elisha dealing with death increasingly radically as we move from episode to episode to episode. So let's just, as we close, trace that escalation. And first of all then, notice death restricted. Death restricted. This is episode 1. Now, we need to appreciate with episode 1 there in verses 1 to 7 that death is not incidental to this story. The sole cause of this family's problems is death. It's not that this family has recklessly accumulated debts, that they've bought too many gadgets, that they've bought a fancy new car, and they've accumulated all these debts, and that's why they get into difficulty. That's a complete misreading of this passage. These would have been ordinary debts in a cultural context where people didn't have savings, and they wouldn't have been a big deal had it not been for the fact that the man of the house had suddenly died. And so the family then, through death, is plunged into poverty and threatened slavery. And when then Elisha averts that slavery and ends the poverty, he's not altering or undoing the death itself. The man is as dead in verse 7 as he was in verse 1, of course. In that sense, this is the least remarkable of our three episodes. But Elisha is restricting death's damage. He's certainly doing that. And he's seriously restricting it. In what was probably a less romantic culture than ours, this was the worst thing about the man's death. Not that the wife would never be able to look him in the eyes again or stroke his cheeks again. It was the fact it plunged her and her sons into abject, ruinous poverty. And this death doesn't plunge this family into abject, ruinous poverty. Its usual effects, death's usual effects on an Israelite family, are mitigated. And the death is restricted in that sense. It's limited in the damage it does through the work of Elisha. And death is restricted for us believers through our greater than Elisha, the Lord Jesus Christ. If Christ doesn't return imminently, we shall all have to experience death. And that's not pleasant. Dying is a grim business. But boy, its damage is restricted for the Christian believer. That is a massive understatement, in fact. Death should plunge you and me into a worse poverty and slavery than any widow in Israel ever experienced. The poverty and slavery of hell death should plunge us into. But instead it won't. It will take us to Christ. In Samuel Rutherford's beautiful words, death for the believer is Christ's ferry boat to take the Christian home. We have a Saviour who has restricted the damage that death does. We shall still die if Christ doesn't come first. But we need not fear it, because Christ, the better than Elisha, has restricted its damage. Death restricted, secondly, death reserved. Death reversed. And this is episode number 2, of course. That's what happens to the boy, isn't it? His death is reversed. He dies and he comes back out of death. And Christ is going to do that for us when he comes. That's what we were considering partly this morning, isn't it? But of course, Christ isn't going to do it with this struggle that Elisha has that we talked about a few minutes ago. Managing a bit of warmth in the body, first of all, and then having another bite of the cherry later on. No. Christ will do it dramatically. And what a contrast that is, actually, isn't it? Between verse 37 of our passage and what we were considering this morning. Yes, it's wonderful that this boy is brought back to life. But there's something a little bit unimpressive about the way in which the woman has to come and pick up her son and carry him out of the room. You compare that with this morning, and when the dead come out of their graves on that day, they're going to suddenly soar into the air with new bodily capacities that they never had before to meet the returning Christ. That's why Hebrews 11:35 talks about this very incident that we're looking at this evening. Women receiving back their dead. And then it goes on to talk about a better resurrection that lies ahead. Because this isn't a proper resurrection. This is the coming back to life of a boy who will die again later on, further down the line. But when Christ comes, it will be a better, a proper, a full-blown, a permanent resurrection. What a prospect that is, isn't it? Resurrection. When Christ returns. I mean, the sheer cruelty of death is emphasized in our narrative here. Comes across in a couple of ways. Verse 20 is just so moving and poignant, isn't it? This child sitting on the mother's lap until noon. There she is cradling this boy whose life is ebbing away from him. It's a moving scene. The cruelty of death. Or you think of her words in verse 28, where she says, "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" She's accusing Elisha of having deceived her when he promised her the son in the first place. Now, of course, strictly speaking, Elisha hasn't deceived her, because Elisha never said that the boy would live for a long time. He merely said that she would have a son. But the point is that Elisha's promise there in that doorway back in those verses, a year prior to the birth, Elisha's promise had triggered in this woman all kinds of hopes and dreams. Hopes and dreams about the boy's childhood, and then his adolescence, and then his graduation from university, and then him getting married and having children himself. It had triggered all of those, and death then has now come along and reduced all those hopes and dreams to a deception. "Why did you deceive me?" she says. And death does that, doesn't it? It shatters hopes and dreams. It's the great deceiver in that sense. But it's going to be reversed. Resurrection is coming. Look forward to that, Christian believer. And so death restricted, death reversed, and then thirdly, death removed. And this is episode 3. What a striking phrase that is in verse 40. These prophets, they don't cry, "Look, the contents of this pot could kill." No, they say there is death in the pot. There is death in the pot. It's a very dramatic way of expressing it. And then Elisha does his stuff, and there isn't death in the pot anymore. Death removed. And you know, the supreme work of Jesus Christ in relation to death is not even death's reversal. That's marvelous. That's an epic prospect. Death reversed in all Christ's people. But the supreme work of Christ in relation to death is not even that. It's the recreation of this world with death removed altogether. There was no harm in the pot, we read at the end of our passage, verse 41. It's an adjective in the Hebrew there. There was nothing harmful in the pot. The verb form of that same Hebrew word is used in Isaiah 11, verse 9. They shall not hurt, it's harm, or destroy in all my holy mountain. And in Isaiah 11, you'll perhaps know it, it's that passage that is looking forward to the new creation. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and the little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not harm or destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So he mentions all these, Isaiah mentions all these aspects of the curse that presently harm. And he says, they will not harm anymore. No more harm. A world from which the curse and harm and death has been removed. Isn't that a prospect? Are there five better words in the Bible than Revelation 21 verse 4? Death shall be no more. Death shall be no more. This pot of stew is a microcosm of the world itself that Christ is going to bring into being. Presently, it's so full of death, just like that stew was full of death. But there's going to be no more harm, no more death in the world when Christ recreates it. The better than Elisha is going to do what the prophet did on a little pot of stew on a cosmic scale, producing a universe in which death shall be no more. Oh, may that hearten us and keep us going in this world so plagued by death, the stench of it everywhere. May we look forward to our Jesus removing even death. Amen. Well, let's close singing number 400.